Good morning. Good morning. Oh, good. This clock's about 2 minutes into, shall we say, Alice in Wonderland time. So I'm really welcoming all of you. I'm Shirley Rand. I think I've met you in that my name is on the signature of the invitation. I thought I should introduce you to me. And I'm really happy you're here. Thank you for being a participant in our 44th year of Learning for Life. It was created because I like to learn. And I always say we've got the smartest women in Chicago who are willing to allocate capital and time in order to learn about cutting-edge subjects on important things in our own life. Life is about creating new pathways in our brain so that we can keep growing and investing in order to contribute to the mainstream of life. And I thank you, all of you. I think that one thing I'm going to do is I do not see it there. We have a really, as you may know, last week was extraordinary to have had Teresa Roland talk to us about how she does not, 15% of research generally is the amount of women that they use in scientific studies. So, and she brought it to the attention of the NIH. Big deal. Very important. Genetic medicine. Listen to your podcast, your cast. We've also asked these wonderful speakers today to please give us their favorite podcasts, and I think they're going to be in your notes when they're sent out by Rachel. One thing I noticed that Rachel is not on here. Professor Rachel Mercy has her PhD in communication, and I think her suggestion is her goal is to make digital communication connect to audiences in a way that create a relationship to empower our democracy and our lives. And so I think it's much better than that. She's got so much wisdom in her head, but she's also filled with life, organization, one of the most remarkable women I've truly ever met. We're thrilled that she agreed to serve as one of our directors on pathways.org. And I thank you for being here, Rachel.
Thank you, Shirley. Thank you. I was reminded this morning, not that you guys keep up with my schedule, but the last time I spoke to you was the morning after the election. You may remember that now. And now I speak to you the morning after we've begun impeachment proceedings. So it's an interesting time to be in this world, and I'm super excited that today is really going to focus our attention on the news in another way. And one of them really comes because of a little challenge we had with the technology this morning. I hope you will pick up the New York Times from yesterday. Celeste Watkins Hayes, who's speaking to you today, wrote an op-ed on the HIV epidemic and the destigmatization of HIV/AIDS with Jonathan Van Ness. I know him from Queer Eye from the Straight Guy, but I did not recognize his name. But Celeste is getting such positive feedback from that, it crashed her inbox, which is every professor's dream. May it be from people reading my New York Times articles and not from students complaining about grades. So, good morning. I'm going to get right to the business of the day because we have four speakers today, and this is probably my most favorite day in Learning for Life because these are four speakers who I also consider friends. We are all members of the Institute for Policy Research, and the couple of times I've thought maybe my future might not be at Northwestern, the Institute for Policy Research always brings me back. And it's very rare that you meet in the academy people who know you know have your back when you're not in the room. And I can say without a doubt these are four people that I would trust. If there was a conversation happening about me and I were not there, I would want the four of them. So I'm really excited to not be just introducing you to experts in their field, but people who I really consider wonderful colleagues and friends. And I'm going to start that by introducing Diane Schanzenbach. We're such good friends that she was able to tell me that I've been pronouncing it wrong for 7 years. So there's that. But you don't often introduce your friends by their last name, I realize. So Sean Zinbach, I'm going to practice. Diane is the director of the Institute for Policy Research, and I'm not going to belabor her intro because you have her bio in front of you. But I do want to draw attention to one really spectacular thing. Diane was elected to the National Academy of Education in this past year. 197 elected members were very proud that Diane is not only a member of the National Academy, but also the director of the Institute for Policy Research. I'm going to let her give you a little overview of the Institute and introduce our speakers today.
Thank you. Is the mic working? We did not sound check it. Yes? Good. All right. Well, thank you. I'm very delighted to be here with you today. You're going to fuss with this, are you? No. Okay. I would love to start by telling you a little bit about the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern, which we think is, frankly, a crown jewel in Northwestern. We have many, many strengths, and we think IPR is one of them. All right, so this is supposed to move forward. Oh, there it is. Okay. It's different from the one I use when I'm teaching. So the Institute for Policy Research just celebrated its 50th anniversary this past spring. We were founded in 1968, and today we bring together almost 50 faculty members from across a number of different disciplines who are the top social science researchers at Northwestern University. Our researchers are at the forefront of studying a range of the most pressing social concerns, from inequality to crime to education and health to the work that Rachel and her colleagues are doing on governance and discourse. We take our mission very seriously, and it is primarily about investing in people to make Northwestern great, and then taking their ideas and their research findings to transform how we talk about policy in our nation and our world. So IPR helps attract and retain world-class faculty to Northwestern. We develop junior faculty, the assistant professors, and also invest quite a lot in our graduate students and our undergraduate students to train even the next generation. So many of the top social scientists at Northwestern would consider the Institute for Policy Research to be their intellectual home. Rachel said that about herself. We're very proud of Larry Hedges, the 2018 Yadan Prize winner. The Yadan Prize is a $4 million prize that's equivalent to a Nobel Prize for education policy research. Larry won this for his lifetime of research on statistical underpinnings of meta-analysis. That's a mouthful. I think Beth is going to unpack a little bit of that later. But what he has spent his whole career doing is helping us understand how to aggregate across many disparate studies to try to understand what does the whole of the research literature say. It's very important work. It's highly technical work. And we're very proud of him for this recognition. We have 2 elected members in the National Academy of Sciences, 5 elected fellows in the National Academy of Education, 3 Carnegie fellows, including Sarah Young, who will speak in a little bit. And we have, in addition to our important academic work, we've made tremendous policy impacts. So, for example, my colleague John Gurian's work evaluating the Becoming a Man violence prevention program propelled it to national prominence, and it became a hallmark of the Obama administration's toolkit to reduce violence in inner cities. My own work on school accountability policies made 35 states plus the District of Columbia adopt chronic absenteeism as a metric of school accountability. What really sets us apart at Northwestern and at the Institute for Policy Research is our deep collaborative nature across disciplines. Northwestern was the leader just nationally in terms of developing interdisciplinarity. We've been doing it for decades at this point. And as a result, we've been able to build a culture that really values across different disciplines. That is hard to build, it's easy to destroy, and it is other universities are jealous of what we've been able to accomplish. It's true. And we take great care to preserve these investments. You're going to see a nice array of the work that the Institute for Policy Research does today. I'm an economist. I'm going to start. But then we also have Celeste Watkins Hayes, who is a professor of African American Studies and Sociology. So we'll have a sociologist speak next. She's also the associate vice president in the Office of Research and an IPR fellow. She, wait, I brought the book up. She is going to talk about her Hot Off the Presses book. We're very proud of this and her work and her New York Times op-ed. And so I look forward to, I'm introducing her now. I look forward to hearing her speak. Next, we'll have Beth Tipton, who's a statistician. Beth was trained at Northwestern, and I don't know if you know, it's frowned upon to keep your graduate students as faculty members in the short term. So we had to let her go off to a Columbia University to be an assistant professor. And the minute that we thought it was appropriate to bring her back to Northwestern, we did so. And she is doing a terrific job in statistics, and she is co-directing the newly formed STEP Center, which she'll tell you a little bit about, which is under the rubric of the Institute for Policy Research. And then finally, we have Sarah Young. Sarah was just tenured last year, and we are delighted to have this long-term relationship with her. She's an associate professor of anthropology. She will tell you about her tremendously important work on water security. At least I hope that's what you're talking about. She is also an IPR fellow. So we've got an economist, a sociologist, a statistician, an anthropologist. That sounds like the beginning of a pretty unpleasant joke. We walk into a bar together, stuck in traffic on Lakeshore Drive. So I get to start by talking a little bit about my research. I hope you've had a chance to read the article that I posted. My colleague Hillary Hoynes and I wrote that for a conference that was held at the White House under the Obama administration about social safety net and food insecurity. Because as you recall, Michelle Obama made a big push in healthy eating and food insecurity. So just to set the stage, I want to note that a large share of children in the United States live in households that struggle to provide their basic need. On the left-hand side is the poverty rate. Poverty is a measure of your total income relative to a threshold that we designate as being the poverty line. Overall, you can see about 12% of people across the nation live in poverty, and children are more likely to live in poverty. So about 16% of children in 2018, these numbers were just released about a week and a half ago, live in poverty. On the right-hand side is a different metric of struggling to provide your basic needs, and this is the rate of food insecurity. It's a concept that's akin to hunger, but it's not quite the same as hunger, and you certainly will hear more about water insecurity in a little bit, but it's basically the idea that the family doesn't have enough resources to purchase the foods that they need to live an active and healthy life regularly. So either they run out of money at the end of the month, or they have to really, cut out vegetables or, fresh foods at different times of the month. What we see is overall, also about 11% of households experience food insecurity. Families with children experience food insecurity at a higher rate, about 14%. You can see it spiked quite a bit during the Great Recession and has, fortunately started coming down as the economy has recovered. So there's a large share of children. And something that we're very interested in understanding is how do our policies and programs help children who are struggling or who are in families that struggle to provide their basic needs? And what kind of long-term impact does this have on them? So I am a leading expert on the food stamp program. It was renamed SNAP about a decade ago for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. About one out of every eight people in the United States receives funding from the SNAP program. These are vouchers that can be used at grocery stores to purchase food to be taken home and consumed. The SNAP program lifts 10 million children above the poverty line every year. This is just an overview of some of our biggest social safety net programs in the United States. Today, the Earned Income Tax Credit and SNAP do the lion's share of lifting families and also children above the poverty line. And you can see, for example, you might remember in 1996, Bill Clinton ended welfare as we know it. That's called the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. And today, it is a very small program, smaller than the National School Lunch Program in terms of lifting children and families above poverty. So SNAP is very important. And what is unfortunate is we know relatively little about its impact. And the reason that we know relatively little is because it's been a very steady program. It's been the same for over 50 years, since about the time IPR was founded. So I'm going to describe a research study of mine that looks at the impacts of SNAP when it was originally introduced as part of the war on poverty. It happened, you know, in the 1960s and 70s, provided additional resources to some families, but because it was rolled out on a county-by-county basis, this gives me as a researcher the opportunity to understand what's the cause and effect of having these extra resources. And in particular, since that happened 50 years ago, we're able to understand what happens when we provide extra resources to families with children on those children's health and development over the life course, because now those children are in their 50s and 60s. So what we have here is we're looking at low-income families in the United States in the 1960s and the 1970s. So in order to conduct this research, what we need to do to tease out cause and effect is compare different families who lived in the same state but in different counties that had different access to the social safety net program. So I've got my two families. You can see both mothers are expecting and have two older children. And one family gets extra resources starting in a particular year, and was for concreteness, I'll say 1967, because of the county that they lived in compared to the county that the other family lived in. This other family didn't receive resources at that point yet. Food stamps didn't come into their county until 1972, when their children were older. So what we can do is compare impacts across siblings based on their age at which the resources were received. So we've got the one child in utero, and what we'll find is that's a particularly important time to protect children, and the two older siblings. So we can compare siblings based on the age at which they were received, and then tease out the answer to the question, what's the impact of having access to food stamps, receiving these extra resources at age 8, at age 2, and in utero? So in 1967, we've got our three children, one's not yet born, one's age 2, and one's age 8. And then we can fast forward to 2016 when our analysis stopped, and so we see them as adults, age 39, 41, and 47. We can see how did they grow up, what kind of work did they do, what kind of health are they in. So this is our group that's treated with additional SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits in 1967. Then we can measure these things, their adult health, their economic success, and how those impacts varied by how old they were when they first started receiving these additional benefits. So similarly, we've got our what we call the control group that didn't receive the benefits until later, 1972, and we can then again compare them when they're adults. You know, what are their economic outcomes? What are their health outcomes? So we'll compare these two groups: the one that received the extra resources during childhood, during early childhood, and those that did not. We'll ask these questions. So that was the sort of fun version of it. Here's sort of the nerdier version. And so this is the variation that we use. This map shows the timing of the introduction of the food stamp program across all the counties in the United States. The darker shaded places adopted the program later. So I'm originally from the state of Missouri, was basically one of the last places to adopt the food stamp program in 1975. But what we're doing in this study is comparing within state across the different gradients of the colors of green. And then we'll use this design to look at a variety of outcomes. We started out by thinking about how do people spend the resources, and they spend it on more food, which is not surprising. Then we also looked to see how did this change mom's labor supply? Did she work less? Did she work more? And basically what we found is anytime you give somebody resources that they don't earn, they work a little bit less, but not a lot less. And then we could also look at birth outcomes. I'm going to talk about that next. So what we find is for that mother who was expecting a baby when this food stamp program came on, we found that the baby was born with a higher birth weight and was less likely to be born at low birth weight. These are pretty substantial findings, or substantial magnitudes, larger for African Americans than for whites, but large in both cases. And we know that birth weight, higher birth weight, translates into better health across the life course. So this is sort of a first, you know, first piece of evidence that we might expect to see longer-term outcomes. So then we can measure these longer-term outcomes. And this is really the cutting edge of science. This was one of the first papers in this literature, but the literature has really blossomed over the last 5 years or so to try to understand interventions in early life on later life outcomes. What you need to do these studies is for multiple pieces to come together. So you need longitudinal data that links together child circumstances and adult circumstances, and that's hard to do. It's just, you know, you have to get lucky. You also have to have a credible research design, like the rollout of the food stamp program that happened, you know, at different counties. And then you also need time to pass, because we have to wait for 50 years to be able to look at long-term impacts. So we have that in this case. And I'll summarize what our findings were. We find that when we look at these children as adults, you know, when they're in their 30s and 40s and 50s, two things really popped out. The first is for both women and men, their health is much better in adulthood. So the way that we measure health here is what's called a metabolic syndrome index. So it's obesity, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart attack, things like that. There's good reason to believe that having more adequate nutrition in early life will lead to better long-term health outcomes. And indeed, that's what we find. These impacts that we find are quite large. To benchmark the magnitude, it reduces the gap between blacks and whites by something like 60%. So these are large impacts of having access to these additional resources from the time you were in utero through age 5. So it's about 6 years of treatment. So next, we looked at a number of different measures of economic outcomes. So overall, this isn't in the graph, but we found that the likelihood that a child graduated from high school increased by 18 percentage points if they had access to these additional resources. Why is that? Well, we think it's because your mind comes in second if your stomach is empty. The kids are going to school with more food in their belly. They can pay better attention at school. They're less likely to need to drop out to help out the family. So here then we turn and look at a variety of outcomes from: are you in poverty as an adult? Are you yourself on the social safety net as an adult? Are you working? How much are you earning, et cetera? We aggregate all of those together for statistical reasons and make it so that sort of better outcomes show a positive impact. So not being on poverty, not being on food stamps yourself as an adult. And what we find is strong impacts on girls, on people who grow up to be women. They grow up to be just more economically self-sufficient if they had these additional resources in early life. Interestingly, we don't find the same impact for men. There is a very tiny green line there that is so small that you can't see it. So the economic impacts are entirely concentrated for women and not for men, whereas health impacts accrue to both women and men. And we've got some theories about why that might be, but not a ton of proof at this point. Sorry, I didn't do that. Another thing that we uncovered here is that timing really matters. And so early life investments have a larger health payoff. Many people in this room, I imagine, are familiar with Jim Heckman at the University of Chicago's pioneering research on the importance of early life. And this paper, I think, pushes forward some of the work that he's been doing. So what we find when we look at long-term health is that the largest impacts are when the mother has access to additional resources during her pregnancy or even before she gets pregnant. But the window does not close at birth. Early life is also very important. The impacts are somewhat smaller for people who get access to this when they're 0 or 1 years old or 2 or 3 years old, but they're still positive and they're strong. But then we find that the window seems to close, and when we look at later life health outcomes, the impacts really close by the time they get to school. Now, this suggests to me the importance of protecting the very youngest children, and I think we are currently not doing a great job at that as a nation. Finally, I'll talk a little bit about when we look at economic outcomes, we find that a dollar investment at any age has a positive impact, but the largest impacts really happen when the child was in utero or in that first year of life. We think this is about brain development. In fact, I was presenting this in front of a room full of brain researchers and physicians, and afterwards a brain researcher came up and hugged me because he thought this was such a beautiful graph. Economists don't get hugged all that often, and so it was a very, it made an impression on me. But what is, I think, very exciting is the people who are really studying brain development and people who are studying policy are all coming to similar conclusions, which there's this special time for brain development, and we need to protect children so that they can develop those brains, which will have a lifetime of payoff for them. There are, like I said before, this paper of mine sparked off a number of additional papers, and people are finding similar impacts from the access to the earned income tax credit, from access to Medicaid health insurance, and I'd be happy to answer questions on that. But so my conclusions here are multifold. First, as part of the spending that we do on young children, especially through the social safety net, is not just charity, but it's also an investment in those kids' later lives. Now, I wouldn't want to push that too far. Of course, I think we should feed children because it's the right thing to do, period. But it is important also to note that not doing that will have a lifetime of consequences for them. It pays returns in terms of better health, better economic outcomes. These impacts appear to be larger at certain ages, which really suggests we need to be protecting the youngest children. And the impacts appear to be larger for more disadvantaged children. That dollar goes the farthest in the poorest households. I think this adds to a proof of concept that that researchers are very interested in that changing early life environments can have a sustained payoff. And there's a particularly cost-effective time to intervene with additional resources. And just finally, it implies just this importance, I know I've said it before, of protecting children from economic hardships, whether that be persistent poverty or whether that be an economic downturn where mom or dad loses their job, and at a special time when their brains are developing, they have this negative shock. And so many economists, including myself, are quite concerned that we're headed into another recession. And this, to me, makes me want to advocate for making sure that we are protecting children in times of economic downturn. So that's my research, and I'd love to turn it over to Celeste.
And good morning. It's truly a pleasure to be here, Mrs. Ryan. Thank you so much for having us. I'm just going to flip this out. I stood at the border and claimed it essential. And the rest of the world moved to where I was. Toni Morrison. What does it mean to be counted? What does it mean when public policy counts us, acknowledges and our experiences and sees us? Hypervisibility, the experience of having one's existence placed under a microscope, interrogated and surveilled, is not the goal. but neither is invisibility, whereby one's concerns and experiences don't make it into the policy agenda, and one is allowed to suffer in silence while others experience the warmth of attention or acknowledgement or care. Such a dilemma was manifested from the early days of the HIV/AIDS crisis. The caretakers of the earliest patients, those lovers, friends, family members, doctors, and nurses who were not afraid to hold the hands of the dying, likely didn't realize then that they were laying the groundwork for what has become one of the most effective policy interventions of the last 30 years. At first, they operated in a world of invisibility due to the laggard response on the part of the government, the lack of compassion for populations most afflicted, and the dearth of viable medical options. But they recruited important, albeit sometimes reluctant, allies to the fight. Sympathetic lawmakers and government bureaucrats who injected words of caution and pragmatism while ensuring that needed resources would be available. Medical providers and scientific researchers who acknowledged the importance of taking up a cause with implications that extended beyond their examining rooms and their laboratories, and social service providers who would help to implement the vision from the front lines. From the grassroots to the rarefied air of the political elite, there is now a grand experiment underway. It's only decades old, but it's proven to be highly successful in helping to transform lives. Its mission is simple: to move people from death to life. Debates within the HIV community about what that goal means and how we get there persist. Should the HIV response focus on a purely clinical definition of what it means to live and die, getting life-saving drugs into bodies? Or is a more holistic interpretation called for, one that improves overall health, social, economic, and political outcomes for populations most affected by HIV, and that pushes against the inequities that fuel the epidemic? The story of HIV activists who opened the eyes of the world to a devastating epidemic is now well known, chronicled in books and film. And their political demonstrations and marches became defining moments of 1980s and 1990s America, fundamentally altering how investigators conducted medical research and doctors practiced medicine to make the patient a partner rather than solely an object. People with HIV spoke up, demanding more rights for patients, access to healthcare and life-saving drugs, and research to understand what was happening to their bodies. The activists and advocates involved in HIV/AIDS were involved in another critical effort at the time, a lesser-known, often overlooked part of the AIDS response. As these individuals fought for treatment and dignity, locking arms, learning as much as they could about the disease that was ravaging their communities, and confronting the ignorance, silence, apathy, and antipathy that threatened their lives and the lives of the people they cared about, AIDS activists and advocates were simultaneously building one of the most effective social and health support safety nets of the 20th century. With healthcare services, modest economic assistance, extensive social support, and political and civic engagement as its pillars, this now billion-dollar infrastructure stands as an underappreciated yet highly effective model for assisting marginalized populations, demonstrating how effective public policy, robust institutional networks, and multicultural coalitions can address what I call the injuries of inequality. Injuries of inequality are the wounds to our personal, family, and community well-being that result from systemic, institutional, and interpersonal violence, trauma, and inequity. As such, injuries of inequality produce and are produced by a compromised ability to protect ourselves from harm. When left unaddressed, HIV compromises the immune system, our ability to fend off infection, but HIV is also the result of inequities operating at the structural, institutional, and interpersonal levels. It ensnares our most vulnerable. And I prefer this term injuries of inequality over social determinants of health, which I find to be the equivalent of using passive voice to discuss injustices and harms directly and indirectly committed against marginalized populations. Therefore, who we count and how we count them matters because it focuses our attention in the places where it's needed the most. So I've conducted over 100 interviews with women living with HIV over a decade. I heard countless stories of trauma and struggle, perhaps not surprising given the devastation wrought by AIDS and the social dynamics that fuel the epidemic. But I also heard stories of transformation. Women in my research talked about moving along a trajectory that began with dying from HIV/AIDS, believing that they had a death sentence, and took them to living with and even thriving despite HIV. And my book bears witness to women's transitions from severe and compounding crises, the body blow of a diagnosis that's at once life-threatening and highly stigmatizing, sexual trauma, chronic unemployment, homelessness, and drug addiction, to major successes such as dramatic improvements in health, the rebuilding of familial ties, hard-won economic stability, civic engagement, and leadership that speaks truth to power. But this progress could only happen if they were first counted. The labor of women in the HIV movement in particular has changed how support services are delivered within the epidemic, bolstered the voices of women in AIDS policymaking, built new communication channels to reach women living with HIV, revised the narrative about women in the epidemic, and even challenged how we understand the disease itself. However, those gains wouldn't be achieved without a fight. So let me share one story. Katrina Haslip from Niagara Falls, New York, was a formidable jailhouse lawyer in the late 1980s. She gleaned much information during her work assignment as an inmate in the library of New York's Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women. Katrina had become a valuable resource for fellow inmates, pointing them to law books and other resources as they fought their cases. For her part, Katrina developed another area of specialization. She had been reading everything that she could find about HIV, the illness in which she was diagnosed in 1988. At the time, New York State Department of Health was reporting that almost 20% of the incoming women in Bedford Hills were HIV positive. They were experiencing severe stigma from inmates and guards alike, as facilities around the country were placing inmates living with HIV in substandard isolation units managed by medical staff, many of whom knew very little about the disease. Inmates at Bedford Hills had formed the AIDS Counseling and Education Program in 1988 with the approval of prison administrators, and the women organized a collective that offered peer education, counseling, support, and health advocacy pertaining to HIV. Around the same time, in 1980s New York, Terry McGovern worked for a public legal services agency. She began noticing a troubling trend: a growing number of women with HIV seeking legal assistance. Many had histories of trauma. Terry began digging into the cases and quickly learned that there was no legal infrastructure to protect women living with the disease. Like the men, the women were coming to her organization looking for legal help to fight discrimination, desperately ill, and highly stigmatized. They needed access to housing, health care, and other services. But they lacked one critical element as women living with HIV, a diagnosis of full-blown AIDS. Gay rights organizations had successfully mounted a powerful civil rights lobby in Congress in the late 1980s to protect people living with HIV/AIDS under the Americans with Disabilities Act, a momentous legal development for the community. This qualified people with an AIDS diagnosis specifically, not just those living with HIV, but an AIDS diagnosis specifically, for Medicaid, Social Security disability insurance, and housing programs. They fought really hard to get that, Terry had acknowledged. But AIDS is a syndrome. Physicians diagnose the disease based on certain known symptoms. It so happened that the symptoms that the Centers for Disease Control used to initially define an AIDS diagnosis for physicians were those disproportionately found in their male patients. HIV-positive women often lacked the bright red skin lesions of Kaposi's sarcoma that affected mostly men, but were instead presenting with gynecological cancers, advanced pelvic inflammatory disease, and recurring yeast infections. Unfortunately, those symptoms fell outside of the CDC's case definition of an AIDS-related illness. Terry explains. So I was seeing this really weird phenomenon, she says, where these women were coming in and they had fallen into a complete state of everything going wrong. They couldn't qualify for Medicaid or disability. If you take a case because someone's been denied Social Security, you appeal, you get their medical records. That was the context in which I saw all these cases. T cells are basically a marker, Terry explained, for how healthy your immune system is. And in the early days, it was a marker for how long you were going to live. You wanted your numbers to be in the hundreds, and these at least. And these women had like 6 T cells, 10 T cells, all over their records. There would be all these gynecological conditions, bacterial pneumonia, cervical cancer, tuberculosis, all kinds of stuff. But their records, Terry explained, would say, doesn't have AIDS. And then I would go to the hearings with them, and basically the administrative judge would kind of accuse them of overstating their illness. So you couldn't win these cases. And often the women would die before I got the rejection in the mail. The issues were hopelessly tangled. Conditions that were not part of the original case definition of AIDS, such as tuberculosis and bacterial pneumonia, were illnesses disproportionately affecting poor people with HIV. And clearly, the gynecological conditions, including cervical cancer, were happening in women. They often struggled to maintain jobs because of their illness and other barriers. Their applications to Social Security, Medicaid, and other programs were denied because they had not been officially diagnosed with AIDS. Moreover, lacking income while suffering from a debilitating illness, they struggle to find stable housing. Taken together, these issues put poor, single, HIV-positive mothers at considerable risk of losing their children to the foster care system. Nobody had thought about the women, Terry lamented. Nobody had thought about the children. It was sad and really outrageous. Terry approached the nascent AIDS Service Network in New York looking for answers. She attended an ACT UP New York meeting and stood in the back, absorbing the conversation. ACT UP had also noticed that the CDC's case definition of AIDS seemed to exclude women. The problem, they charged, was that the studies of AIDS had focused disproportionately on gay men, and the resources dedicated to studying HIV among women were woefully inadequate. So we realized, Terry explained, that the whole system around relief for people living with AIDS was really problematic for women. To borrow from scholar Alexis Shotwell's characterization, disease classification was operating as a political formation with material and economic effects. Terry founded the HIV Law Project in 1989 with funding from several New York foundations. Gathering a small number of clients' medical records, she filed a class action lawsuit against the Department of Health and Human Services in 1990, charging that the government's AIDS definition overlooked disease symptoms in women and arguing that it was inappropriate for the Social Security Administration to use that definition to determine eligibility for benefits. Recorded as SP versus Sullivan, the case was so sensitive that Terry had to use the plaintiff's initials in court documents to conceal their identities. To demonstrate her claims' scientific credibility, Terry and other advocates encouraged doctors to publish their observations about their female patients. But these physicians were having their own struggles, getting their colleagues to recognize the significance of the epidemic among women, given the systematic underemphasis on women's health and the underfunding of research about them and about us. Terry soon realized, however, that the case needed willing and knowledgeable spokeswomen to raise public awareness and pressure government officials. Around that time, Terry was hearing from her formerly incarcerated clients about this lady in Bedford Hills. Terry wrote to Katrina, and the two formed a relationship. One of Katrina's observations, this inmate in Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women, made a strong impression on Terry. AIDS looks different in women, Katrina said. When Katrina was released in the fall of 1990, she was hired as an AIDS advocate and helped to motivate the women involved in Terry's class action lawsuit to speak out. The Women's Caucus of ACT UP was also organized for the fight, launching highly visible demonstrations at HHS offices, Department of Health and Human Services offices in D.C., proclaiming that women don't get AIDS, they just die from it. Activist women of color living with HIV, including Phyllis Sharp, a plaintiff in Terry's class action lawsuit, and former sex worker and writer Iris De La Cruz, offered moving testimonies as demonstrators spiritedly chanted, "How many women have to die before you say they qualify?" Katrina attended the ACT UP demonstration in D.C., violating the terms of her parole to lend her voice to the struggle, traveling out of state. As ACT UP women's activists mounted a direct action campaign to challenge the CDC and the National Institutes of Health to change the case definition of AIDS and to increase the amount of research on women in the HIV epidemic, Katrina became a regular and vocal presence at various gatherings. Waiting for the case against the federal government to wind its way through the courts proved agonizing. Terry and her team routinely filed motion after motion in family court to preserve clients' rights to visit with their children who had been removed from their homes due to their mother's physical deterioration, homelessness, or issues that predated but were often related to their HIV status. As the HIV Law Project attorneys fought to maintain that bright spot, their clients died one by one. Local health departments encouraged the group to press on as they too witnessed the explosion of women with serious HIV-related illnesses and desperately needing greater services and resources for people, for people with AIDS. Katrina's health declined precipitously over the course of the fight. She did not qualify for a home health attendant or other resources through the Division of AIDS Services because she too lacked an AIDS diagnosis. As she repeatedly fell at home due to weakness, Terry literally had to send other clients to help her get off the floor of her house to take her to the hospital. Finally, the CDC announced that it would expand the case definition of AIDS starting in January of 1993 to include those with T-cell counts below 200, pulmonary tuberculosis, recurrent pneumonia, and invasive cervical cancer. Katrina's dying in the hospital, Terry explained, and I went to tell her. She was really angry because it didn't have to be that way. She didn't have to struggle the way she did. Katrina died on December 2nd, 1992, exactly 1 month before the CDC's new case definition would take effect. She never received the services or disability benefits reserved for people with that designation. Partly as a result of the changes in the case definition of AIDS, the CDC saw a spike, as you might expect, in the AIDS surveillance statistics among women. We were counted. This change effectively forced the Social Security Administration to expand AIDS-related disability criteria, allowing more women and low-income individuals to qualify for Medicaid and Social Security. But this development was about more than government benefits, as Terry explained. That was one aspect of it, she said. But it was also about whether you were spotting people who might have AIDS and counting them. It was about who was vulnerable and how that got defined and what we did about it. It was also about science, as the discovery of effective treatments depended on the full consideration of evidence in both men and women that could be utilized to accurately reflect the realities of the disease. The AIDS safety net that exists, really we had to fight our way and claw into to earn, Terry reflected. And frankly, it's always been led by HIV-positive women, especially those of color, against incredible odds and obstacles. When the HIV Law Project created an initiative to train women to participate in AIDS advocacy and activism, they named it the Katrina Haslip Technical Assistance Program. Katrina Haslip, her views are reflected in a statement that I found about her work in Bedford Hills. Katrina had this to say to us. These women working together believed that none of their peers should be discriminated against, isolated, or treated cruelly merely because they were ill. These were women who understood my silence and yet felt my need to be heard. I had never noticed in my peers this ability to care so deeply, for I too had labeled, especially the women that I was surrounded with in Bedford Hills, as prisoners, cold and uncaring. Yet we managed to build a community of women, black, white, Hispanic, learned, illiterate, robbers, murderers, foragers, rich, poor, Christian, Muslim, Jew, bisexual, gay, heterosexual, all putting aside their differences and egos for a collective cause to help themselves. I could not believe my eyes. Right before me lay a model of how we as a whole needed to combat all the issues that AIDS brought. And we were building it from behind the wall of a prison. We were the community that no one thought would help itself. Today, the billion-dollar HIV/AIDS infrastructure stands as an underappreciated yet highly effective model for assisting marginalized populations, demonstrating how giving access, centering their voices, leveraging institutional networks, and generating coalitions across the borders of prison, across the borders of nations, across race, class, sexuality, and gender can help address injuries of inequality. The AIDS safety net created by the community represents a politics in action at the level of both policy and institutions, making women's transformations from dying from to living with to thriving despite HIV possible. And I couldn't help but to note the significance of the HIV safety net and its importance for those who have experienced compound injuries of inequality in the recent op-ed that I published in yesterday's New York Times, after Queer Eye's Jonathan Van Ness disclosed his HIV-positive status. Van Ness is healthy and has described the efficacy of HIV medications that allow his viral load to be undetectable. This means that he cannot sexually transmit the virus to other people. That achievement of scientific progress, the movement of HIV from an inevitable death sentence to a chronic and manageable illness, is one of the most significant social and medical achievements of our time. And in this moment of promise, with the work nevertheless to be done, we must remember the contributions of women like Katrina Haslip and Terry McGovern, whose work helped us to get there, who made sure that we were all counted and that there would be services and a safety net for those who needed it. I stood at the border, Toni Morrison once said, stood at the edge, and claimed it as central, and let the rest of the world move over to where I was. Thank you.
Wow, what a tough act to follow. I mean, as a statistician, I feel like anything I say at this point is going to seem tremendously less powerful than what you just said, Celeste. So hang with me, please. I want to talk about statistics and why statistics matters in policy. It seems probably like the most dry thing possible. And it seems like it could not possibly have an impact on real people in some way. It's just a lot of math equations, right? And so I just wanted to put up here what it's sort of the driving way that we think about it in the center I'm going to tell you about, is, which is that statistical methods themselves propel the kinds of questions that we ask. If you have a method, it opens up new questions. And so you can't ask questions if you don't have a way of studying things with them. That's how science works. the sort of recognition that statistics and the way that we have methods and tools, that they're important for policymaking led us to start the STEP Center. The STEP Center is statistics for an evidence-based policy and practice center. And so our vision is that I like the way we put this, that we believe in a scientific approach to transform the social world and a practice-driven approach to advance science. So our goal is to start with the questions that people have, real questions on the ground in policy and practice, and then to think, do we have adequate methods in science to actually answer those questions? Is the disconnect between research and practice because we can't translate our results, or is it because we are not asking the right questions because we don't have the right methods to ask those questions clearly? In the center that we just started, we're focusing on three broad areas of this this sort of relationship between research and practice. There's methods in all of these areas. So one of them is generating evidence. This is, you can think of randomized trials, methods for isolating causal effects, and randomized trials are used in all sorts of fields, from medicine to education to social policy. Sort of it touches in all areas of what IPR does. Synthesizing evidence focuses on taking existing evidence and combining it to look kind of broadly about what the evidence is. This includes the field of meta-analysis, where you take many studies on a similar topic and you pool them together and you average them and provide sort of not just what one study says, but what 100 studies say. It also includes an area called clearinghouses, which are areas where you have small numbers of studies but all on the same intervention. So you might have 3 or 4 studies on a particular curriculum in schools, or you might have 3 or 4 studies on a particular social program, and you, again, are pooling those together. So that's just to emphasize that these meta-analyses can be very broad or can be very specific. But they're, again, about pooling evidence. And then that sort of last process is the translation of evidence. So what are the methods that we have? How do we do well when we're trying to translate the kinds of findings that we get in science to people like you? And so this is sort of the most understudied of the areas, and we're trying to make a big push in this area. So it might include things like what sort of outcome metrics can regular people understand, not just scientists who've gone through a lot of indoctrination into a way of thinking. What visuals are ways that people can understand results? How can we actually study that instead of taking guesses about what makes things understandable and allows them to sort of interpret results clearly, but how can we actually study that in a way and make it better? I'm going to just talk about some of my work that fits into the generating evidence. I think it'll give you a sort of a sense of what I mean by the role of methods in research. So I do a lot of work with randomized trials. And in particular, I do a lot of work with randomized trials in education. But much of what I'm going to say about education context is very similar to clinical trials in medicine. And what I want to do is highlight for you why they're so important. I think, you know, if we looked back 10 or 15 years ago, there weren't that many randomized trials that were happening in education. In fact, people thought it was impossible, really, to do randomized trials. They'd say, well, it's impossible for us to give some schools or some kids an intervention and not others. That wouldn't be fair. But over the last 15, 20 years, we've got now over 200 field experiments that have been conducted, funded by the Institute of Education Sciences, which is the sort of research arm of the Department of Education. And results of those trials, as well as many other trials, are published in something called the What Works Clearinghouse, which was also created around 2002. It's a clearinghouse where you can go in and look and say, I'm looking at this program, what is the evidence on this program? And it will tell you if I'm looking for a reading curriculum, what kind of reading curriculums exist for the grade levels I'm looking at, what is the evidence on them, do they look like they're going to be effective interventions or not. Importantly, I would add to that, is that you need to show evidence in order to use federal dollars in the Every Student Succeeds Act. And so it becomes this sort of interplay between we need evidence in order to make sure that schools are choosing evidence-based programs. In other realms, these experiments are important too. So in development, there have been also, the World Bank and J-PAL have funded over 200 randomized studies in education, social welfare, and health. These are in developing countries, and there's an explosion, I think, of this kind of research in developing countries, where they're randomizing villages or people or towns, etc., to receive all sorts of different kinds of interventions and to see if they're actually effective at reducing poverty or improving health. And then nudge experiments. I'm sure many of you have heard, I feel like nudges get a lot of sort of press. These are like grit, growth mindset, a whole bunch of different, like little, the idea being that there's like a little systematic tweak and that it will have big ramifications. And so they're becoming really common in economics and psychology, social psychology in particular. And even, you know, there's been an executive order sort of pushing for the use of these in government areas. So there's a way in which these trials are conducted kind of in a scientific way, and yet they all have policy ramifications. It's not just science. When you are doing things at this scale, large experiments, we're not talking lab experiments in any of these cases. We're talking experiments in schools, experiments with hundreds, thousands of patients, etc., that when you're at this scale, the results end up mattering in a policy environment more so than an individual laboratory study might. So I want to review for you what happens in an experiment. And so what I've done is I've made a little like sort of picture. These are supposed to be schools. That's about as artistic as I can get. So imagine this is the education context that I do a lot of work in, that on the left we've got this sort of sample of schools that are in our study, and then we're going to flip a coin, basically, and you're going to divide them into some group that will get the treatment and some group will get control. Now, the control in most education studies is business as usual. So that just means you continue doing whatever you were going to do, whatever program you were using, anything like that, before you, for the course of this time. The treatment might be an intervention, so these are sometimes like a reading program, a math program, they might be an anti-bullying program, any sort of, it could be a social, another social-emotional program. Any of these programs are typically occurring at the school level, so the idea is that all of the teachers at a particular grade will be teaching with this new curriculum. And the important part here, what I'm describing, is in these studies, schools are randomized. So that means so a whole school is considered getting this treatment or not getting this treatment. And at the end, let's say, of that year, you get, this is my math notation for you, you calculate the average. So that's just called Y bar T and Y bar C, which just means I've got the average outcome in the treatment group and the average outcome in the control group. And that's what I calculate at the end. So it could be that I have an intervention teaching kids how to read using a new reading program. And at the end, I use a Dibbles or I use some sort of test of reading comprehension. And I look to see what the average reading comprehension is in schools that received the program and the average comprehension in the schools that didn't. Now, the important point here is, on average, these two groups are similar before I get the intervention. You see how they each have one red and four green. So they're similar at baseline because of randomization. And when I randomize, that's kind of the magic of randomization, that they're similar. And the only thing different about them is that one group got the treatment. Okay? So we call this the average treatment effect. The average treatment effect is just the difference between those two groups. So if the treatment, group does better, then we say that it looks like there's a positive effect of the treatment. It could do worse. It could be pretty close to similar, in which case we would say we don't really see evidence that this treatment makes a difference. Importantly, this is a causal effect, and I really want to highlight that. It's a causal effect, meaning that we can isolate what the cause is here. It's not just I observe the difference in these kinds of schools versus these kinds of schools, which could be caused by all sorts of different factors. In this case, we randomized and manipulated by giving some people a treatment and some people not the treatment. And so we know, if we see a difference here, we know where that came from. Okay, I want to go back to this image, though. There's something I didn't point out before, which is, what if the treatment doesn't work the same for everybody? What if, in Celeste's case, what if an intervention might work different for men than women? What if, in schools, an intervention works different in some kinds of schools than other kinds of schools? And so I'm actually using red and green here for this reason. Assume that the green schools are schools that, if they got this intervention, would have a positive effect of the intervention. This intervention really works in those schools. And think of the red schools as schools that this intervention doesn't work in. So if the school, if this particular kind of school gets the intervention, it doesn't really have an effect and may actually have a negative effect for some reason. And so you have to think, well, why would an intervention have a negative effect or a positive effect? Well, it's easy to see that schools have contexts, and you can imagine that there's different kinds of students in different schools. Teachers have different kind of training. Teachers have different kinds of demands. Schools have different levels of resources. So a reading intervention that goes into a school that is really well set up for bringing in a reading intervention is going to do better, potentially, and actually really lead to outcome changes than an intervention that maybe goes into a school that has limited resources and teachers are already stretched and they don't have enough books and there's all sorts of things working against them, and now it's just one more thing which actually makes outcomes worse because they're juggling too many things in changing a program. So now we have a case in which I'm reminding you that this is an average treatment effect. It's not a treatment effect for everybody, that different groups, different schools, different people hypothetically have a different treatment effect that they could have. Again, it's the same thing to say in the medical context that a drug might work differently for men than it might work for women. So something that's effective for men might not be effective for women, or people of different ages, or people with different sort of health levels to start with. And so again, I'm just highlighting, this is an average. Okay, so this is where my work comes in. If it's an average, then the sample matters, okay? So I just said we started with this sample of schools and I randomized them to treatment and control. But what if I told you that on the right, that was actually the population? And so now we can see there's a problem. My sample is actually rather different than my population. So in my population, I have green schools, schools that where a program might be effective if it were implemented. I have red schools where actually it would make things worse because maybe the context is just such that they're not ready for an intervention. And I have yellow schools that this intervention is just going to be a wash. It's not going to make a difference. I can't necessarily just like look at schools and know that, but I'm just saying this is sort of the, what if this is what the population actually looks like. Now, if I look over at my sample, you can see a problem. I have mostly green in my sample, and there's not mostly green in the population. In the population, there's a lot more red and yellow. This is actually not that far off from what happens in experiments, because often in education experiments, researchers recruit schools that they think programs will work in because they want to get a big effect, because it's expensive to do a trial. Okay, so you look for schools that maybe already have partnerships with your university, schools that you've already worked with sometimes, in fact, because you know that they are what some people will say are with it, that the principals are, have good leadership, they're kind of with it, they can implement a program. They would exclude schools when they're recruiting if they're if it seems like they might be hard to work with, if it seems like it might take a long time to recruit them. These are all indicators, potentially, that the intervention would be more effective in some places than in others. So people are recruiting to the best that they can based upon where they think they'll see effects, as well as sort of, I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second, convenience. There is not, so while we focus a lot on randomizing people to treatment and control to make those equivalent, we do not focus a lot on how we select the samples. And this is true not just in education. This is, again, true in medicine, right? So in medicine, you have the same problems where we've had more men in clinical trials than women. I was at an NIH meeting where somebody pointed out that the average age of a person getting pneumonia is 60, and the average age of a person in a pneumonia drug trial is 30. Because people, in the way you design trials, you're trying to isolate people with only pneumonia, nothing else. And so you end up, all of these inclusion-exclusion criterias make those that are in the clinical trials really different than those that are in the population. Okay, so what this means in sort of more technical language is that the sample average treatment effect that I just told you about in our sample with all those greens might be bigger in this case that I showed, but it could be smaller in other cases than what the average treatment effect would be in the population. So this is a huge point, right? So if the point of doing randomized trials in schools at the level, at this big studies with 40 schools in them, and putting them in the What Works Clearinghouse is supposed to be that this provides us evidence on which to make decisions, the fact that these schools that are in these studies or the people that are in clinical trials are different than those populations is really problematic. How problematic is it? So I have a study going with some colleagues in which we've selected 40 randomized trials in education, and we interviewed 37 principal investigators about recruitment and what happened in recruitment in those trials. How did you recruit? And then in 34 of those studies, they were able to tell us the locations of the schools. And so I just got sort of up here a map of the U.S., and in the map, all the little gray dots are schools in the country, and all of the colors give you a sense of where the schools and studies are. And what you probably, I hope, can immediately see is that this is not randomly distributed across the country, okay? So it turns out between these analyses and conversations in these interviews that the way recruitment occurs is about location of the principal investigator. And principal investigators are not randomly distributed across the United States because our top Research One institutions are not distributed randomly across the United States. So wherever there are big areas where there's research and research hubs, you see more research and more schools being involved in studies than in other areas where they're not the top tier research institutions in the country. Also, sometimes this has to do with the location, even specifically of the top schools of education in the country, because this has to do with people in schools of education doing research. So what you see is the West Coast California is really overrepresented, Florida, up through the East Coast, and even Texas. There's a ton of research that occurs in Texas. What I found surprising is, given the poverty levels in the United States, that the Southeast has less research occurring there than I would have expected in particular. So given that a large proportion of the sort of low-poverty schools are in the South, that's not where these research hubs are, and so we're seeing less research in those areas. The other driver is that researchers have to recruit samples pretty fast. Now, this is a structural problem that has to do with the funding in our country for research, okay? This is not something insurmountable, but it means that it's a question for the way that we do science. So if you look in the population, if I was just looking at districts, school districts in the country, the average school district has about 6 schools in it. But the average school district in research has 38 schools in it. Okay, so we're favoring large school districts. We're also favoring larger schools. So we have more schools with more students. Large schools. Those are advantageous for doing randomized trials. Large districts, because I can go and get permission from a district and now recruit all 40 schools from the same district. And I have reduced the cost and time involved in getting schools into my study. This is not researchers being sort of nefarious or lazy. But when we interview researchers, it's about the real constraints provided to them by the funding models, that you have to get your schools, you have 3 years to do this study, you have the money, you've got to move, you've got people staring you down saying you need to have the schools. It's really hard to get schools. And often the larger school districts are in urban areas near where researchers are anyway. So it's all, the deck is sort of stacked against everybody in the system as it is now. Furthermore, it turns out 90% of school districts have 11 or fewer schools in them in the country. And so that's that. So those. So that means only 10% have more than 11 schools in the country, and yet 54% of those in studies are in school districts that have more than 10 schools. So these small school districts, which represent about 50% of schools and 40% of students, are greatly underutilized in research. District size is correlated with other things. District size is correlated with urbanicity, for example. So about a third of the population of schools are in urban areas in the country, but over half of the study schools are in urban areas. And the other part that you see this is that about almost half of schools are in towns or rural areas in the country, and those are greatly underrepresented in research. They're hard to get to. So rural and town schools are in smaller school districts often. They're further away from research hubs. They can be much further away from the urban areas where Research One universities are, and it makes it harder for researchers to get into those schools. And yet, a substantial part of schools needing research and needing to know what works are in those areas. So the implication is that we have a system in place to sort of translate research from scientists to the What Works Clearinghouse and to get it out to people, and yet there's a great mismatch because of the way we've sort of structured our scientific process between the kind of research that we have and the kind of research that people need. And so our hope is that building methods and highlighting this kind of work and thinking about how to do this better will change practice and will encourage researchers to be more aligned with the populations that actually need research. So I'm just going to highlight one of the ways that I've worked on to do that. And so I have, like as good statisticians do, done some sort of algebra and math and written some papers, done some simulations, et cetera, about how you could better sample schools to represent the population. What could you do? How could you take a population perspective? What data is out there? And I realized at some stage in doing this that I'd written a series of papers on this and that I had this data that I worked with. And then I thought, okay, so I'm going to give this to a researcher who's writing a grant proposal, not yet funded, and I'm going to say, yeah, you just read these papers and download this data, and you do this analysis, and then you'll have a recruitment plan. It'll only take you like a month or two, probably, to figure all of that out. And so I realized that that was a problem that I could solve, right? So I got funding from, at the time, the Spencer Foundation. And I've continued to have funding since the Institute of Education Sciences has continued this, to build a tool called the Generalizer. And it's a web tool. You can go right to it yourself if you so desire. And the idea is it has data in the background, so nobody has to download their own data. It's got population data. It's got the methods in the background doing the methods for you. And so in under an hour, you can start from the beginning, define the population of schools that you're trying to study in the United States. It will walk you through the process of creating what's called stratified recruitment. It just divides schools into sorts of buckets of similar schools. And then at the end, it actually emails you lists of schools in the United States, their addresses, and information for you to begin recruitment. And it says, like, you need 40 schools. There's five different buckets you need to get them from. And here are all of the schools possible in each of those buckets for you to start recruiting. Thanks. And so the idea is for that to be one nudge moving people forward. Now, I would have hoped that this would have radically transformed the world. It has not radically transformed it in the way that I had anticipated, partly because people still have these constraints. I've sort of learned in this process, this is the supply. There needs to be demand, which is, I think, a push from people to say, I want you to represent our schools. And we, as funders, et cetera, are willing to put pressure on researchers to do that. It has been used as an approach, though. So I will say it's not used by everybody, but it has been used. And this is just a sampling of studies that I have been involved in that I know have done this, as well as some others. And I'd want to point out one of these studies is actually we used a random sample, which is people think of as really impossible with schools. And this was evaluation of a growth mindset intervention, which is Carol Dweck's work,
looking at that at scale in schools. And so we actually did randomly sample schools, which I think is might be the first time somebody has done that in this sort of education context. And that is it. Thank you.
Is the tech guy here? Mr. Tech Support, could I summon you from your magic cabinet? Okay, thank you. Do you know how to make it full screen?
So is this off?
This is a PDF.
Oh, it's a PDF.
Or maybe try here.
So this is a PDF need to be made full screen. Yeah. You might could just probably just download it.
It was dumb.
Was it playing off of Edge?
It's not a, like, it's not, it was just downloaded to the desktop.
How did, oh, which site?
I don't know. It was just on the. Maybe stop the continuous.
The continuous scrolling. Can you turn that off? Right. Turn that off.
Is that good enough?
Good enough if we can advance.
Up there, it definitely is.
Yeah, but can it advance now?
Now we just need to figure out how to.
Good morning, ladies. I always tell my students one of the hardest things about teaching isn't the knowledge or the presentation, it's the technology. And I just proved my own point. So thanks for your patience. And nothing delights me more than seeing a room full of smart women. Like, this is exciting. So I realize that I'm the last thing standing between you and lunch. So I'll try to keep it short and snappy, and hopefully a little bit engaging. So today I'm going to answer four questions. And those are, why is measuring experiences with water important? And water's all around. We often don't think about it, but I'll argue today we should be measuring it. I'll tell you about how we used to measure it. My third question I'll answer is, what is the HY scale? Hint, hint, it's a great way of measuring water. And my last question that I'll answer is, what will implementing this scale tell us? But I like to start with taking a step back to just remember how special water is. I mean, in the universe, of all the solar systems, we're the only place that has this amount of water. Supposedly they found a couple of drops on Mars, but it's not going to quench any of our thirst. And our life depends on water. Sitting here, we're somewhere between 60 and 70% composed of water. We came to life in a sea of water. And on land, we of course drink. That's a maybe a more obvious one, but 70% of the world's water goes to irrigation. We need water for cooking and for cleaning up the dishes after we cook, and for cleaning our grubby little babies after we feed them and after they make us dirty. Water is really also important for spiritualism, and it features prominently in all the major world religions. But as it happens, 4 billion people face water scarcity. So that's not enough water, at least a month of the year. And that's based on what we can know from the satellites. Okay? So there's a lot of people who don't have enough water, but there's even more people who are experiencing problems with too much, so flooding, and also problems with quality. And I mean, who hasn't heard about Flint? But Flint is the tip of the iceberg, and in my own children's schools, there's problems with lead. So experiences with water matter because lots of people are having adverse experiences with water. And to date, we haven't really known how to measure that. So in my like boring scientific papers, I don't tell juicy backstories, but I can tell you an interesting backstory today, standing here, which is that I am not an expert in water. I think a lot about maternal and child health. This period called the first 1,000 days, Diane and I are like kind of sister presenters here. You're food, I'm water. We both care about kids developing. And so much of what I do focuses on breastfeeding and anemia, a little bit of HIV, all these really important conditions in this vulnerable time. And I think about them from a nutritional point of view and from as an anthropologist. And I was studying food insecurity in the first 1,000 days. I had a big grant from NIH. And I was working to quantify the impacts of food insecurity, which, as Diane pointed out, isn't hunger, but it's concern about quality and quantity and stability of food. So we were investigating how food insecurity impacted economic well-being, nutritional well-being, physical health, and psychosocial well-being of moms and babies. And it's really easy to measure food insecurity. We asked these questions over the last month. How often have you experienced, from worrying about having enough food to eat all the way out to going for a day and a night without having anything to eat at all because of a lack of resources? This is not fasting. And then we can easily sum the number. So 0 is never, 3 is often, 9 times 3, 27. So measuring food insecurity is easy, which is good because that was the outcome I was interested in. But with my anthropologist hat on, I wanted to make sure I was asking the right questions. So I knew what I thought was important, but sometimes other people think things are important that I don't necessarily think about. And in this case, this was a very important instructive moment for me. So what I did was I took cameras and I gave them to moms and I said, Diane, please take a picture of what influences how you feed your kids. And this was in Kenya. I expected like failed crops or sick chickens. But what I got were pictures like this of water. And water and the stories behind all of these, I could take 20 minutes telling you those. I'm not going to do that, but feel free to ask me later. Here's just one quote. So this is the water we use for cooking sometimes. It comes from the prison called Kodiaga. And the prison people let the sewage drain into it. So this mom had to make an impossible decision between buying clean water to prepare food and not have any food to prepare, or to buy food and then use this water to prepare the food. Here's just one other example. So this mom had just delivered a baby, and she was too weak and sick from this delivery to go and fetch water. So she sent her kids to fetch the water. And in this case, they have the porridge powder, but they didn't have enough water to be preparing the porridge. This is food and water insecurity are tightly coupled. For those of you who did your homework, and yes, this will be on the exam. No, it's not on the exam, but the paper that I circulated showed sort of all of the ways, the very far-reaching ways, that water insecurity impacted women's lives. And it impacted women directly and children directly, but also children through the well-being of their mother, like moms being dehydrated and not producing enough breast milk. One of the most striking to me was intimate partner violence. So it's like a good reason. There are quotes here. Good reason to beat up your partner if there's not water in the house for bathing, and et cetera. Okay, but I digress. So remember, I have this beautiful NIH study design being able to quantify the impacts of food insecurity on all of these outcomes that we all agree are really important. So I ran to the literature to be able, because I wanted to measure water insecurity too. I mean, clearly this is something that is impacting lives in ways that I couldn't even imagine. It turns out we have lots of ways of measuring water. We have hydrologic indicators, which is like how much water there is out in the world. We have national level data on how many cubic meters per capita there are. And we have lots of data on water quality, like lead or E. coli. But in this middle zone here, we don't have, I hope the animation isn't too distracting, sorry about this. We don't have ways of measuring water insecurity in the same way that we can measure food insecurity. And as you saw from Diane's work, food insecurity is really setting the agenda for all kinds of policies. So all we knew how to measure was what people's source of drinking water is. And just because you normally have tapped, if you have a tap in your house, it doesn't mean that water is always flowing. It often means it often isn't. So there's much more than drinking that we do with water, and I wanted to measure that. And so if we think of the Household Food Insecurity Access Scale as the brother scale, I would say we need a sister scale, the water insecurity scale, to measure experiences of household water insecurity. So what you ask is this fabulous HY scale. What I'm not going to do is tell you about the technical development. I love talking about it. You can also ask me questions about all the statistics that went into it. I'll just tell you briefly that what we did was we assimilated items because there wasn't something that was globally relevant. But there were great scales developed, for example, for Bolivia or Ethiopia or the Texas-Mexico border to ask about water insecurity. But some of those questions were really specific to Ethiopia or to Bolivia or to Texas. And we wanted something that would work globally. So we took items that we thought were good candidate items to work across the world. There were 32 of those. We wrapped our ethnographic understandings of how water works and all the things that people do with water, and we implemented them. We implemented the heck out of them, in fact. We did it in 28 sites. I led this study. 8,000 households in places around the world that had lots of piped infrastructure, like Kathmandu. Places where there was no infrastructure, like Singida, Tanzania, in places that are hot and cold and flooded and dry and seasonally dry. So this is heterogeneity in water problems. And then we reduced those items because nobody wants to ask 32 items if they can ask far less. And we did that using theory and statistics and a lot of discussion with colleagues all over the world. So we did these stats, we did this sort of consulting the literature, and we had a lot of meetings, and you can see these are site PIs from around the world, and some short people who live in my household. And we eventually whittled it down from 32 items to 12. And these are the magic items. They will be published this week in the British Medical Journal of Global Health. And these are, I'm happy to put these up at longer length, but these are simple experiential items of how often were you not able to wash clothes, or how often did you worry about water? How often have you felt angry about your water situation? And it's valid. That is a statistical, technical term that I will gloss over to say what that means is that it works. And the scores are equivalent. And what that means to say is that we can ask these questions in Pakistan or Nepal or Kenya, and a 7 there is comparable to a 7 in Singida, which is important when you want to be comparing, which is the purpose of this. And this scale is ready for broad implementation. And as my mom likes to say, timing is everything. And the timing of this scale is pretty serendipitous. The UN has declared this to be the decade of water action. And one of their first kind of, this is what we need to do in this water action decade, they talk about not being able to manage what you can't measure. And then they're calling for higher resolution data. Yes. So what will implementing this age-wise scale tell us? And there's kind of three types of information. And the first is, what is the prevalence? So right now, we don't have a benchmark of water insecurity worldwide. We have that for food insecurity. We don't have that for water, and they're both necessary, but certainly water is, you can last for just a couple days without water. And so this prevalence of water insecurity is information that's highly relevant for all kinds of policy. And I was so delighted to be giving a talk at the Royal Geographic Society in London, when there were some representatives of UNESCO who were there. They gave me a really hard time with their questions. Like, what about this? And this Greek man, Alexandros. What about this? What about this? But then he went away from that meeting and reached out to Gallup, who does this amazing, the Gallup World Polls. You've heard of them, yeah. So they do nationally representative sampling for 140 countries in the world, and they are excited about this. They have this, Gallup has a track record of collecting data on a certain phenomenon, and that phenomenon then becoming a sustainable development goal indicator. Everyone knows sustainable development goals? Good. They'll set the track record that sets the agenda for many, many policy decisions around the world. So Gallup collected data on food insecurity. It became a sustainable development goal indicator, and there's precedent for all of these outcomes. And they're on point with this. They sent their ambassador to the launch of our age-wise scale in D.C., and this wonderful woman is talking about that how UNESCO will be working with this group to produce the first global picture of water security at the household level. My mom was really proud of that picture. So there's something else that the HY scale will tell us too, which is, what are the consequences of water insecurity? So we know that food insecurity is far-reaching in what it does, from school performance to even GDP. Food insecurity touches us in lots of ways. But water insecurity, we don't really know how it works. There's lots of plausible evidence, for those of you who read the article, Gold Star, that water insecurity touches on all these outcomes in this particular Kenyan population. But it's not quantified around the world. So the science, I like to say, is wide open. If you do a Google Scholar search with the quotes household food insecurity, you'll get like 16,000 references. I mean, people care about food insecurity, and it sets the agenda for example, USAID. If you do a Google search for household water insecurity, you'll get 180 references, and you know, half of them are from our consortium. We just don't understand yet how water insecurity works, what it does and what causes it, what the consequences are. So the science is there. But also there's some, not that science isn't real world applicable, because it is, but even more immediately applicable use of this is to monitor and evaluate interventions. So I think the World Bank is 200 and, nah, I'm going to make up a number, a kajillion dollars a year on water infrastructure interventions. But those, we know if a dam is built, we know if a borehole is dug, but we don't know if your score for water insecurity goes from 16 down to 4. And that's the kind of, we want to know what the end user's experience is, and this is, we can use this scale to do that. So a number of organizations are already implementing this. I was meeting in London with Oxfam last week, super excited and on board. And a number of other organizations are also getting really excited about this. I was speaking with the director of water for the Food and Agriculture Organization yesterday, and she sees a lot of potential for it. So all this is to say that now is the time for this global benchmark on water insecurity. Problems with water aren't going away, and they likely are getting worse. And if we can understand where we are now and how water impacts how we care for our children, how we grow our crops, how we live as a planet, we'll be doing a favor not just for science, but for humanity. So with that, I want to acknowledge my many colleagues. This is a really hard study to do. I'm standing presenting it, but it's the work of many. The funders and collaborators, which have been phenomenal. And to thank you for listening.
I'm going to invite all our speakers to turn their microphones back on and take a seat at the front so you can ask questions, but I think you'll understand now why these are a great group of friends to have. I've been known to ask one of them, who should I vote for in the upcoming election, when I don't know all the details. So you can see what an educated group. So all four of them are happy to take your questions. Please raise your hand. I'll repeat it just for the purpose of the, just briefly for the purpose of the recording, and then they can answer. Is about desalination on the coast. Please, Sarah.
So the sites where we worked were places where there were different types of water problems. What we haven't started doing is looking at solutions. So desal is one that comes with strengths and weaknesses, but we haven't quite gotten to that.
Please, Jackie.
So the question is about Head Start and food insecurity. Sorry, this is the downside of recording.
That's perfect. Thanks. Thanks for that question. Head Start mostly is for four-year-olds. It's increasingly for three-year-olds. We're still missing the boat on the younger children. It's to be sure, you know, we've got good evidence on Head Start providing both nutritional inputs and also educational inputs that we have also documented as a field that those have long-term impacts on kids. But you know, our primary way of feeding young children is either the food stamp program or we have this special supplemental program called WIC. WIC covers almost half of infants in the United States. It's tremendously popular for infants to buy formula because formula is very expensive. But then we see that one-year-olds and two-year-olds really drop off of these various programs in ways that are at exactly the wrong time. You know, and even WIC sunsets before kids get into kindergarten. And so they don't even have access to school meals yet. And so I would argue that just the lay of the land on policy is that we're really doing it wrong for the youngest kids, and that's where the biggest bang for the buck is.
But I do have a question regarding the lack of resources for the food, and wonder what you think about lab-grown plant-based protein to transform the way we eat and prevent famine and helping feed people who are in poverty.
So the question was about lab-based plant protein. What do you think about sort of lab-based created food? You might both have a take on that, Sarah.
Well, it sure is good for our water use. I mean, one of the real advantages of this eating more plant-based protein than animal is the water footprint of meat compared to vegetables. And that makes me kind of excited to try the Impossible Burger.
I have tried it. It's delicious. I would say my own research is primarily in the United States. And so, you know, I was looking at your slides and thinking about the porridge and there's not enough water and thinking about how different hunger and food insecurity is in the United States. I just joined the board of the Greater Chicago Food Depository, which is a fantastic organization that does so much to feed struggling households here in the Greater Chicagoland area. And our sort of next steps are all about prepared foods, sort of making sure that we are providing meals to people who can't prepare their own food. So whether that's elderly folks or children in daycare situations, you know, et cetera. So I think just what food insecurity looks like and what are the next steps in the United States looks quite different from what it looks like in developing countries. And I'm just very proud that we're working, you know, across all of these fields, because I think that what the science is showing is sort of children and their development is broadly similar across that. It's really important to feed them both here and there.
Yes. The question was about water quality and sort of the legislative action against water quality.
Yeah, the Clean Water Act is a pretty good idea, I would say. And it is extremely disturbing to know that protections are being released. I'm happy to say that my husband listens to the things I say. And I know this because he's a synthetic biologist, also a professor at Northwestern, who is doing a lot of work on diagnostics for point-of-use diagnostics of water. We don't have, I can say this to ladies, we don't have like a pregnancy test for water. I mean, pregnancy tests are really nice and easy to use, right? Clear Blue, easy. And so what he's doing is working on ways to be able to detect contaminants in water without waiting weeks and weeks and spending hundreds of dollars. It should be a few cents per test and quite rapid. Because I do think that there's real concern about the quality of water. Even as lucky as we are, there are new and untested contaminants of concern.
Please. I have a question for Celeste. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there work going on to help people who are at risk to keep them, help them from being exposed to the disease?
Absolutely. We currently have a...
Let me just repeat for the recording.
Go ahead.
So the question was really about the incidence of HIV/AIDS, especially under at-risk populations this day and age. Please.
So we currently have about 1 million people living with HIV in the United States. We're still seeing 40,000 cases a year. Which is quite troubling given that we now have the biomedical tools available. We know how HIV is transmitted, and now we even have medications that PrEP, you might have heard of it, pre-exposure prophylaxis, where if you take that daily, it virtually eliminates your ability to become HIV positive. So that's being rolled out as a very important prevention initiative. And the other half of the coin is making sure that people who are living with HIV are what we call virally suppressed, such that there is so little of the virus in the body and detectable in blood tests that it can't be transmitted sexually. So we now have two tools, both for people who are HIV negative to prevent acquisition, but also for people who are HIV positive to prevent transmission. So the question becomes, why do we still see 40,000 cases a year if that's the case? And it really becomes a sociological challenge in terms of access and making sure that people are getting access to the medications. But what we also know is that the people who are most affected by the epidemic are also the most marginalized. So when we think about low-income populations, we think about sexual minorities, people who are traditionally on the margins of society, making sure that they're getting and taking that daily pill for PrEP, and then making sure that they're getting tested to even know that they're living with HIV, and being able to get on the medications that are going to virally suppress them becomes a real challenge. Because as you saw in what I illustrated, the many different challenges and barriers people are facing. If folks are worried about where they're going to live, where they're going to sleep, they're dealing with sexual trauma and a whole host of issues. issues, they're much more likely to make sure that they're taking those medications every day. So we're at a really exciting point in terms of the biomedical intervention, and that's why we're seeing people who are saying, I'm healthy and I'm doing well. Those are the people that are taking the medications and doing quite well. But we've got a long way to go to make sure that people are still getting access to consistently take those medications. Well, that's one of the interesting issues. For PrEP, it does not, in a lot of different cases. It depends on the state and where you are. For some states that have really made the investment, it does, but the majority of states don't necessarily cover access to that to make it a zero-cost medication. What you're going to start to hear more about in the policy conversation is the end of the epidemic and in the end of the epidemic initiative. And in the State of the Union address, President Trump talked about this goal of ending HIV, the HIV epidemic by the year 2030. What he's talking about is increasing access to the medications to both prevent and treat people living with HIV. So there's a very strong movement underfoot to really kind of think about rolling out access and making it more affordable. But it goes back to the question of, even if you give people the medications, are they going to take it if they're dealing with a whole host of other barriers and challenges and issues? And one of the things that's really interesting about the Jonathan Van Ness case from Queer Eye, who was on the Today Show yesterday, is his discussion about his drug addiction challenge and the notion that even had he been diagnosed, he wouldn't have necessarily taken the medications because he was battling the addiction. Those are the kinds of challenges that we're dealing with to make sure that the drugs are available and that people are actually using them as prescribed.
That was a question about kind of international water insecurity versus here in the United States.
Yeah. Well, I think it was Mark Twain who said that whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. And I mean, maybe it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but wars are fought over water, and the sort of the consequences of problems with water, like migration caused by crop failure or not being water, it's kind of hidden. I mean, water is a little bit hidden. So to your point, there's a lot of conflict and outcry with problems with water. Here in the United States, we still have lots of water for now. Unfortunately, I become a little bit apocalyptic the more I study problems with water. I mean, we have water in good quantity for now, but it's not always going to be like that, and the price of water isn't reflecting the true value of water. So I think we're going to start to see, and we're even seeing, you know, people leaving their houses along the coast because of flooding, property value decreasing. This will become a bigger issue here in the United States for sure. I mean, even in Chicago, in the Chicagoland area, something like 50,000 households have had their water turned off for non-payment, and several million households across the United States. So to your point about meals that are ready to eat, I mean, water is becoming a problem here, and I think you'll only see it more.
I have a question for Elizabeth. Are private school and charter school data, is that data typically included in the data that you're talking about for school sampling?
It is not.
So typically the school data that that is publicly available, there's data, it's called the Common Core of Data. It's a kind of a census of schools every year. By the time we get it as researchers, it's lagged data, so it's a couple of years behind. And the way you get that data is schools report that data to states. States then report that data to the federal government. And it includes sort of demographics on schools. It includes charter schools, but it does not include private schools. And so an important question would be what sort of data there is available on private schools. An interesting thing with research is that very often research does actually occur in private schools and charter schools because it's easier to get into those schools in some way than it is to get into some public schools. And so it becomes a tricky problem that we don't actually have much data on those private schools and how similar or different those private schools are to public schools in order to think about if something works in private schools, does that tell us what works in public schools or not?
Ladies, we have a wonderful tradition at IPR. We meet every Monday at noon where one researcher gives a talk and we ask all kinds of questions. We bring our own lunch. We have lunch provided for you today. So I hope you will stay, ask questions. Thank you to Shirley for having us, and I will see you next week. Please join me in thanking our panelists.